A report by the Urban Strategies Council showed that African American boys made up 17% of the district's enrollment, but 42% of all suspensions, and were six times more likely to be suspended than their white male classmates. And many disciplinary actions were for, quote, defiance. These nonviolent infractions like texting in class or using profanity with a teacher. The national group Dignity in Schools is declaring this week the National Week of Action on School Push Out. What are the alternatives to suspension? How do they work? Join us after the news.
BBC News with Marion Marshall. The United Nations has warned the warring factions in South Sudan that they must agree a ceasefire to rescue the country from civil war. The two sides are preparing for peace talks in Ethiopia, but reports say fighting is continuing. The UN says more than 100,000 people have been displaced by the violence, and that number is expected to go up. Some of the worst fighting has been in the town of Bor, from where tens of thousands have fled across the River Nile. The BBC's Alistair Leithhead has just reached one of their camps.
When the shooting began, the people of Bor fled the only way they could, across the Nile. Tens of thousands of them are now camped out here along a broad swathe of the riverbank. Under each one of the trees that scattered the landscape, a family has set up home. They brought only what they could carry. They moved fast and in fear. Now the food is almost gone. The dirty Nile water is causing sickness and diarrhea, which is overwhelming the small emergency clinic being run by Médecins Sans Frontières. And still, more people are arriving by boat.
The head of the Palestinian mission in the Czech capital, Prague, has been killed in an explosion at his residence in what police say appears to have been an accident. Rob Cameron reports.
Jamal al-Jamal had only presented his credentials in October and had spent just two nights at his residence at a newly built diplomatic complex in a northern suburb of Prague. The Palestinian Foreign Minister Riyad Malki told the AP news agency that Mr. al-Jamal had decided to open an office safe that had been sealed for 30 years. For reasons unknown, this triggered an explosion, causing severe injuries to Mr. al-Jamal's head, chest and abdomen. He died several hours later in hospital.
The Russian President Vladimir Putin has visited the city of Volgograd, where two suicide bombings killed 34 people. Steve Rosenberg reports.
In his New Year address to the nation, Vladimir Putin had condemned the recent bomb attacks in Volgograd as inhuman and had pledged to fight terrorists until their total destruction. Today, during an unannounced visit to the city, President Putin laid red roses on the site of one of those blasts, Monday's trolley bus bombing, and visited the injured in hospital. At a meeting with security chiefs, the Kremlin leader described the attacks as an abomination.
Doctors treating the former Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon say there's been a serious deterioration in his condition. Mr. Sharon, who's 85, has been in a coma since 2006 when he suffered a stroke. A spokesperson for the Shebar Hospital in Tel Aviv didn't give any more details. There's been an explosion at a hotel in the Somali capital, Mogadishu. Reports say the blast was caused by a car bomb and was followed by bursts of gunfire. The Jazeera Hotel near Mogadishu Airport is popular with Somali politicians. Ambulances are at the scene. World news from the BBC. Pope Francis has spoken out against violence and prejudice in his first New Year blessing since taking office. Addressing tens of thousands of pilgrims in St. Peter's Square in Rome, the Pope called on people to accept each other's differences and resist currents of feeling that can lead to conflict. He urged Catholics to show courage and hope in the year to come. More than 10,000 people have marched in Hong Kong to demand the right to free elections. Some of the protesters expressed doubt about the Chinese government's pledge to allow a free vote for the territory's chief executive in 2017. Juliana Liu reports from Hong Kong.
Urged on by protest leaders, Hong Kong residents have rallied to demand the right to choose their own chief executive. After years of delays, the Chinese government has finally agreed to allow universal suffrage. But many residents fear Beijing will use its power and influence to filter out candidates it deems unacceptable, thereby robbing voters of a free and fair choice. The protesters believe a Beijing loyalist will erode Hong Kong's core values of freedom of speech, human rights, and the rule of law.
There have been more clashes between Muslim and Christian militia in the Central African Republic, where at least 1,000 people were killed last month. Residents of the capital, Bangui, describe seeing groups of Muslims throwing grenades and setting fire to the homes of Christians, who then launched revenge attacks. There were also exchanges of gunfire. At least one person is reported dead. The manager of the seven-time Formula One motor racing champion, Michael Schumacher, says he's in a stable but critical condition in hospital in France, where he's being treated for severe brain injuries. Schumacher is in an induced coma after hitting his head in a skiing accident at the weekend. His manager said there'd been no significant change in his condition. BBC World Service News.
Welcome, I'm Hannah Baba, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The national group Dignity in Schools has called for a national week of action against school pushout this week. Every year, some 400,000 students here in California are suspended, while another 18,000 are expelled. And according to a recent study conducted by the Urban Strategies Council, there are black students are being punished disproportionately. The study found that while African American boys comprised 17% of the Oakland Unified School District population in 2010 to 2011, they comprised 42% of students suspended. Almost exactly a year ago, the OUSD School Board made a voluntary resolution with the U.S. Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights to eliminate bias in school discipline. Meanwhile, the OUSD has also adopted restorative justice, a method of resolving conflict through mediation circles rather than punitive measures, as official disciplinary policy for the district. And this has statewide implications as well. Governor Jerry Brown signed five bills that deal with school discipline, including two sponsored by Tom Amiano that would allow suspension and expulsion only after other methods, including restorative justice. So today we're asking, what do you think school discipline should look like? What do you think is working and what is not? And joining us today is David Yusum, conflict resolution practitioner, facilitator, and consultant. He's currently the restorative justice program manager for the Oakland Unified School District. The goal is to eliminate racially disproportionate discipline. David joins me here in studio. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
Good morning. With us also is Eric Butler. He's the restorative justice school coordinator at Bunch High School in West Oakland. He's a Hurricane Katrina survivor and relocated to Oakland. He's worked with other survivors. Prior to moving to Oakland, he worked as a domestic violence counselor, facilitating groups to hold offenders accountable and support them in reintegrating into their communities and families in positive ways. Eric also joins us in studio. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning.
Good morning. And Damon Smith graduated last year from Bunch High School in Oakland and went through the restorative justice program there. And he also joins us in studio. Welcome.
Good morning, y'all.
Good morning. And, you know, we want to invite the audience into the conversation almost immediately. If you're a teacher, if you're an administrator, a student, a parent, what is your experience of school discipline? What have you found works? You know, and what hasn't worked? Have you ever experienced restorative justice? And what has it done for you, your child, your niece, your nephew? And to give us a call and make your comment, the number is 866.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Your Call. So unfortunately, we can't take any of your phone calls.
Or shoot us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Something really interesting happened in the Oakland School District last year. They voted to unanimously embrace restorative justice as a method of replacing suspensions. And this was, you know, a voluntary resolution. And it focuses on replacing suspensions, which historically Oakland Unified meted out to African-American boys, which with much greater frequency than other students. And the resolution includes about a dozen other specific actions the school district must take. And many of it has already begun. So, David, how groundbreaking was this for you, and what did this decision mean for the district?
Well, I'm glad that the Office for Civil Rights had investigated OUSD, because it really put a microscope on the work that we had already been doing around restorative justice and eliminating racial disproportionate discipline at OUSD. You know, we've been doing RJ, you know, restorative justice at Oakland Unified since about 2006. And, you know, we'd created the Office of African American Male Achievement, and we had passed a board resolution saying we wanted to move away from punitive zero tolerance policies of discipline. And so I think the Office for Civil Rights saw that we were making an active effort to, you know, dismantle the school to prison pipeline and eliminate racial disproportionate discipline. And so, you know, it put a little bit more of a mandate on it for us. And I think that's a really good thing. There's a lot more schools now that are interested in using restorative practices to create a positive school culture and school climate, and use alternatives to suspension. So, you know, we feel that discipline should really be a learning process. You know, I don't think there's much learning that happens when you push a kid out of school via suspension. So with restorative justice, restorative practices, you know, we hold youth accountable in a very real and meaningful way that keeps them within the community and also provides healing for whoever's been harmed, including the youth who may have done the harm in the first place.
Yeah. Who have traditionally been neglected in the process?
Well, I mean, traditionally, if there's something, you know, a youth makes a mistake or, you know, exhibits some sort of behavior that's inappropriate, they are pushed out of school, you know, via suspension. And they'll just be sitting at home for a few days, feeling isolated, alienated, falling behind on their schoolwork, not being in class. And it may not, there may not be necessarily any safety issue. So I think suspension can be used as a tool for creating a safe environment. But unfortunately, it's, you know, when you've got that hammer, everything starts to look like a nail, you know. And so our suspension rates are through the roof. And unfortunately, African-American students are being suspended way beyond their proportion, their percentage in the district. And so that's a violation of their civil rights, quite frankly, and which is why the Office for Civil Rights investigated our district. So, you know, we need to figure out a way to serve our youth. And we're using this, you know, old model of discipline, and that doesn't, that's no longer, you know, workable. It's no longer relevant in Oakland. And so we're not, we don't want to sort of fix something that's broken. You know, the school district isn't really broken. It's doing exactly what it's designed to do, which is, you know, graduate some kids and push other kids into the school to prison pipeline. So we don't want to fix that. We want to completely replace it with something that's relevant and meaningful and works for the youth in Oakland.
When someone hears, you know, African-American boys in Oakland were six times more likely to be suspended than white boys, mm-hmm. there's a racial aspect to that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are racial issues involved in this move towards restorative justice. The Urban Strategies Council did research on the statistics that led to the decision. And I'm wondering, you know, how do you unpack that, or what does this say about the bias of discipline in Oakland public schools? Mm-hmm. Is it just kind of blunt racism, or?
Well, I think there's an institutional and structural racism that exists, and it's not necessarily racism from individual people, although that exists as well, I would say. But, you know, adults really need to do a lot of reflection on their biases, what triggers them, what their privileges are, and how they respond to students. You know, we really need adults in Oakland that work with youth to operate from a trauma-informed practice and not be so triggered by behavior that could really just be a coping mechanism for what the youth are experiencing at home or in their community or in their neighborhoods. And so, you know, we say we do discipline one adult at a time, and really it's about working a lot with adults around responding to behavior, trying to find what the function of that behavior is rather than just dealing with the behavior itself. And, you know, with restorative practices, we're able to, you know, in a pretty relatively quick conversation, get to the root of what's really happening. You know, a student might be, you know, say, tapping their pencil incessantly in class, and, you know, the teacher might, you know, ask them to please stop, and they don't, and before you know it, it sort of blows up.
And that's the defiance?
That would be considered defiant. And then a teacher, you know, now in front of all the students is being, you know, they may feel disrespected. And so often,
these are young men,
right? And so they can, so, you know, that could end with the student being sent out of class to the office or even being suspended. And so, you know, with a restorative conversation, we can find out, you know, maybe it's the anniversary of that student's brother's death or their father's incarceration or something. And you know, the first question we typically ask is what happened, not why did you do that? It's what happened, and start from wherever you like. And, you know, students, you know, they know, and they start from, you know, a year, 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm. So, Eric Butler, let's get kind of a vision of what restorative justice looks like. Mm-hmm. You're the man who makes it work at Bunch High School. Why don't you give us an idea of what it is, how it works? What do you do?
Well, the first thing that I do with restorative justice is start building relationships and having intentional conversations around needs and values and a place where we can start to have these intentional conversations. So the first thing is definitely just building relationships and trying to get to know the kids and trying to get the kids to get to know me.
How and which kids are you trying to get to know?
All of them. And not just
they've
kids.
Been in trouble. They haven't been in trouble. It doesn't matter. You're going to get to know all of
every
them.
Every single person that comes on the campus. And not just the kids, staff and faculty. And it's just harder to have a non-community type atmosphere if you're getting along with everybody and if everybody knows you. So my intent is to show people the goodness of myself and bad and just to get to know folks in a real kind of way.
And then someone gets into some trouble, mm-hmm. or a couple of guys get into some trouble, right. What is your role? What do you do?
Well, somebody gets into trouble, I've already built that relationship with them, so it's way easier to ask them, like David said, what happened. A lot of times our kids are stuck in this place where they don't trust us. So even with a question like what happened, it usually falls on deaf ears if you haven't built that relationship, because we're dealing with kids who've been lied to by people that look exactly like us. So they're not as quick to have that conversation. So the most important thing and the first thing, like we talked about, is building those intentional relationships. That gets lost in the whole school process or the learning process. We definitely have answers for kids that are slower in algebra or not catching on in English. But when kids have problems having those intentional conversations and how that manifests itself usually in their behavior, our answer is to get rid of them and get them out of our face. But we build those relationships intentionally so we can deal with those problems that are going to come up.
And do you feel that building those relationships actually prevents problems from happening in the first place?
I absolutely know that though building those relationships prevent situations from happening. With the intentional relationship building, we've been able to cut down suspendable offenses by a dramatic decline. We don't have many at all. It's kind of hard to put a number on it because those incidents do come up, but it's not uncommon for me to go to school at any particular time and see kids already sitting in circle, ready to have that conversation about the problem that they're having.
So tell me about that circle then, that process.
Okay, well, So first, we build these relationships, so it's easy to have those conversations. As situations come up, we're having that conversation. If a kid is having a problem with another kid, I've already asked them to trust that we can deal with that situation before doing it the old-fashioned way or the way that we're used to doing it. So we built a relationship and we have trust, and now we're actually having these problems, and it's not they want to have these conversations, and we just haven't been giving them the space and the opportunity to have these conversations.
And they sit in a circle and do what?
And we talk about the root causes of these problems. It may be, for instance, a couple years ago, I had a kid come in and he put his head on the desk. Now, his problem wasn't with a student, but it was with a teacher. The teacher came in and the teacher asked him to put his head on the desk and wake up. And he fell back to sleep. And finally, the teacher felt like her power was being taken away from her, so she needed to go to her next steps, which was to send his kid to the office. She nudged him, and when he got up, he cursed her out, which is definitely a suspendable offense. So the paperwork gets started. We send that situation to the principal. The principal hears about it. Oh, my God, this kid just cussed out one of my teachers. We have to get rid of him. I asked for permission to be able to talk to this kid. The kid cussed me out. And I felt like we needed a little bit more time. So I asked if the principal would give me some more time before sending the kid off, and just had the kid sit there in my classroom and offered him the opportunity to speak whenever he was ready. And finally, he just said that my mother relapsed. And I've been bringing my sisters to school every morning, waking up an hour earlier. At night, I have to feed them dinner. I have no idea where my mother is. I don't want to report her, and this is a neglectful situation, but that's my mom. And so me and this kid had a really deep conversation about the root causes of his problem, which was he was missing his mom. After I was able to translate that to the principal, the principal's exact words were, this kid should get an award for having the diligence to come to school. And we were just getting ready to suspend him and remove him from our community. And that's what happens more often than not. We get rid of the kids before we even have that intentional conversation.
And that's what you're doing.
And that's what we're doing.
And that's Eric Butler. And now let's go to Damon Smith. Damon, you graduated last year from the same high school where Eric is working. You went through this restorative justice program. You guys were in the New York Times last week, huh?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, sir. Okay, so why don't you tell me a little bit about your experience with restorative justice? What was going on, and what did the program do for you?
I had got removed from Oakland Technical High School and got put in a bunch because it was a situation in which they called it strong arm robbery, and I got removed from the school like immediately the next year. So when I got to Bunch, I just assumed it was like, you know, like Dewey or Rusdale or any other continuation school, same problems, different place. Mm. But when I got there, first person I saw was E and
E,
you and Coach Leon.
E's Eric.
Yeah, and I had found out I had it looked like an anger management class to me. So when I got there, just like everybody else, I was iffy. Oh, we gotta sit in a circle. I gotta tell this man my life story. And then he got in class and was like, I'm not as boring as y'all think I am. I want y'all to know that. Those are his first words, if I remember. Mm-hmm. And after that, I kind of just had a feeling something good was going to happen. But then, like I said, Bunch seemed like any old other continuation school, bunch of problems with teachers. And then we finally had like a real circle in his class, like where we talked about what makes us mad at a situation and how can we prevent it. I think you passed out blue papers and we looked at all the techniques. And
had this been the first time someone had asked you, what do you feel, or what do you think is going on with you?
This was actually the first time I ever had any type of conversation or even got close to a conversation like that. Like, I didn't even talk to my mom like that before I got the bunch, really. And I can definitely say it changed my life. I think a lot faster now. I talk a lot less mess, and I graduated like I thought I wasn't going to do. And
congratulations.
Yeah.
You're listening to Your Call. I'm Hannah Baba, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. The number to call in is 800-866-798.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Your Call, so unfortunately we can't take any of your phone calls.
Getting to know what goes on in students' minds and homes and hearts before they are quote-unquote defiant or misbehaving, and sitting in circles with them, understanding their backgrounds through this restorative justice process. And if you have a question or a comment you'd like to make, by all means, give us a call, 866-798-8255.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Your Call, so unfortunately we can't take any of your phone
calls. We want to know your experiences from your family, your school, your district, your children, your own self. So, Eric, I want to ask, what are you to them? What are you called? Because you're not a teacher, you're not an administrator. What are you to them? Are you a coach?
No, I'm their friend. We have a real friendship. They do have a reverence for me because I have one for them. It's a mutual respect. I prefer to be called E by the initial in my first name. That's what all of my friends call me. And I don't like to say I give them permission to call me E. I just think that they call me what they call their friends. And it's a mutual respect.
And it's worked.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And when you hear someone like Damon say, you know, it's changed my life, mm-hmm. what does that mean for you?
It's the reason why I do this work. For many of the students, and maybe not Damon. Damon's special. And all of the kids are special. But they...
In their own way.
Yeah, well...
Yeah.
They're searching for exactly what we're given in it, and we call it restorative justice, but it's a humanistic way of living. It's all about mutual respect and it's love work. So when I hear that Damon came from a school where he was going to get kicked out of school for probably forever. When he got sent to Bunch, the plan for Damon was he'll probably get pushed out of Bunch and he'll hang out on the corner and if we're lucky, the police will pick him up and we'll get rid of him forever. And it's because of some mistakes that he made when he was a kid, younger than he is now. Some of the same mistakes that I made when I was a kid. And to think that...
Do you tell them about your mistakes?
Oh yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I'm an open book, and sometimes a little bit too open, but I think that they learn from our experiences, and what they have is a lot of negative people giving them the benefit of their negative experiences without any solutions. So I give them the benefit of my experiences, but I also offer some solutions. I tell them that I'm not perfect. I make mistakes now. Mm-hmm. And I also tell them about the times where they teach me things that I use in my everyday life. And it's more often than not, they're doing the teaching. And I'm setting up the space to have the conversation, and I'm selfishly learning all of the juice that they give me every day.
I want to know more about that, but we have to go to a break now. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Hannah Baba. We are talking restorative justice, how this program is implemented in Oakland Unified School District. Send us your emails, feedback at yourcallradio.org. We'll be right back after this break. For those of you joining us now, I'm Hanat Baba, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today, how is restorative justice affecting troubled students in schools? We're talking about these programs in Oakland. Last year, the majority of suspensions in Oakland were of African-American students, and then the school district returned to restorative justice as a way to resolve conflict and decrease the number of suspensions. So today, we are getting into the restorative justice program. How does it work? And, you know, is it working? And we want to hear from you, 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Today we're speaking with David Usum, Program Manager for the Restorative Justice Program with the Oakland Unified School District. Also with us is Eric Butler, Restorative Justice School Coordinator at Bunch High School in West Oakland. And Damon Smith, a graduate of last year from Bunch High School in Oakland, and he went through the restorative justice program there. So join the conversation, and we will start taking your calls. You are starting to call in indeed. So let's go to our first caller. Let's go to Ann in Santa Cruz. Welcome to Your Call.
Thank you so much. When I turned on my radio and heard you talking about restorative justice, I was so excited because it's such an incredible program. I'm a teacher, and I've just seen it work so well with all age groups. And I wanted to bring up a program that I saw, which was about a program in Baltimore where they're also using restorative justice, and where normally the kids would be sent off to juvie like right away, and then through the restorative justice program, things were resolved in a way that nobody had to be sent to juvie. So I'm just so excited about this program
okay.
for many levels.
All right. Thanks so much, Anne. Excitement from Santa Cruz. Let's go to Oakland. Deborah in Oakland. Hi, welcome to Your Call.
Hi. Yeah, I wanted to say I'm a teacher in the district, and I think most teachers love restorative justice, and I think the vast majority of us do not want to see kids suspended unless it's for, like, a violent type of behavior, but anything else, even defiance or, you know, using profanity or whatever, we don't want our kids not to be there. But I do want to say that despite all of that, you know, teachers, especially high school teachers, but that's kind of where my background is, we see 160 kids a day, and it's really a lot of people, many of whom, you know, have real challenges in their lives. And I don't always have the time, as much as I would really like to actually sit down and talk to each student in a 53 minutes long when there's so many other things that I'm under so much pressure to do. And I've asked kids, you know, would you come after school, before school, lunch? And, you know, often they really don't want to, even when I'm really trying to take that extra time, but I can't always do it during class. And sometimes just out of frustration, I feel like, you know, I can't go on with the class because of whatever the behavior may be. And, you know, I do wind up sending them out of the room, and I always feel terrible about it. But on the other hand, there's other kids in the class that I'm also wanting to be responsive to. But for me, the thing that would change things in tandem with restorative justice would be much smaller classes. Mm. I don't want to see 160 kids a day. I want to see enough that I can know and care and, you know, assess and work with and address the needs of each one.
What school do you teach in, Deborah?
I can't do it with 160 people a day. Only a few kids are.
Deborah,
really
what school do you teach in?
Right now I'm on a leave, so I'm not teaching anymore.
Okay.
Several high schools in Oakland.
Okay, thank you so much for your call. David, teachers, you know, they are crunched for time. They are crunched to teach to the test. She sees 160 students. She said she doesn't have time to sit with every single student and see what's wrong in their lives.
Yeah. Yeah. Teachers are my heroes. I don't know how they do it. It is a really difficult task. You know, restorative justice it's not a program or a curriculum that we give teachers. It's not like here's the guidebook, do it step by step like this. It is a philosophy of being and doing. And it takes many years to make this culture shift. You know, we're a culture, we're a society where crime and punishment is really infused in our, you know, thinking processes. And to move away from that into more accountability and healing can take a long time. And you know, Eric kind of touched on it earlier. A school that's implementing whole school restorative justice or restorative practices, that philosophy, they're spending most of their time building relationships. And, you know, you asked about the circle earlier. You know, a lot of teachers will use circle in advisory or some other parts of their class, maybe once a week, twice a week, to build community and create shared values, shared guidelines with each other. And while that might be, you know, some people say, well, that's nice to do, but there's a lot of learning that needs to happen as well. And the fact is that spending time up front, focusing on relationships, saves time in the long run. And the reason is because you are allowing students in your classroom to bring who they are and their cultural values into the classroom so that they have ownership in that classroom and they feel like they're represented there. And that is the beginning of eliminating disproportionate discipline, because you're providing an equitable, culturally relevant classroom where students feel like people care about them, where they feel like they've got some ownership in the classroom, and they're practicing and learning social-emotional skills. And so restorative justice is a philosophy that can help teachers provide the environment conducive to learning in the classroom.
And today we have the example of Eric and Bunch High School, but in which other schools is this implemented in Oakland?
Yeah, so we have 20 schools approximately doing whole school restorative justice.
So there's someone like Eric in all these schools?
No, not necessarily. We also have 8 schools that the city of Oakland provides a grant through Oakland Fund for Children and Youth to do peer-based restorative justice, which is similar to peer mediation people have heard of, but it's expanded into restorative justice. And that's at 8 middle schools with some overlap to those 20 whole school sites. Some of those schools have a restorative justice coordinator. Other schools have a team approach where there's a culture and climate team, and that team supports the implementation at that school. Other schools have people like a therapist or an outreach worker that also fills the need, or, you know, wears the hat of a restorative justice coordinator. Because we lack the resources financially and personnel-wise to provide each school with an RJ coordinator, we rely on other models. But I would say that, you know, the team approach is really a sustainable model where you've got people from different walks of the school, you know, a parent or a therapist or a teacher or an admin person, a school security officer, all learning about, thinking about, and practicing restorative justice, and then supporting the other staff of the school in doing that. And also not just kind of springing it on the students, mm-hmm. but including them in as part of this culture shift in the conversation.
Right.
And, yeah.
So let's go to our many callers on the line. Let's go to Jenny in Watsonville. Hi, Jenny. Welcome to Your Call.
Hi, good morning, and thank you for having me on the show. I love this show. Well, I wanted to say that I work for Pajaro Valley Prevention, which is a dedicated nonprofit to the school district, to Pajaro Unified School District. And our focus is primarily working in Watsonville, which is probably about 80 to 85% Latino. And we work in collaboration with the school district to assist students who have been suspended or expelled. And we call this program Valor, which means strength or courage to make a change. And we have a team of a mental health counselor, case managers, and a parent educator. So what the school district will do is give us the names of the students who are about to be suspended or expelled. We call a family conference and invite the youth and his family or whoever is part of that support, natural support. And we ask them, we present the issue, and we ask them if they would like to participate and how they can also provide the support for their youth to continue their education.
So, Jenny, you catch them before the suspension?
Before and then after.
Mm.
Yes. So we have, because of different funding sources, there are different populations that we target. So we receive some funding from the school district. So that would be for the students who are suspended. And we also are partners with the Watsonville Police Department. And through the funding that we get from them, we work with students who have been expelled.
Okay. Great. Thank you for sharing that, Jenny, from all the way from Watsonville. They're doing RJ over there. Mm-hmm. Let me just go to another caller, and we will go to Rita in San Francisco. Hi, Rita. Welcome to your call.
Thank you. I'm a school bus driver here in San Francisco, and I went to go pick up a couple of my kids at a middle school yesterday, and they were suspended. One was suspended for five days. And I really think the way that we are handling suspensions is not a good idea. I don't believe that suspending the kids is good. And I liked what I've heard so far, and I was just wondering, are you guys over here in San Francisco at all?
All right. Thank you. Thanks, Rita. Yeah. So are you in San Francisco?
Well,
David.
There's restorative practices are happening in San Francisco, in San Francisco Unified School District, for sure. Mm-hmm. I'm not in San Francisco.
Right.
I'm in Oakland.
Right.
But San Francisco Unified is definitely taking on restorative practices, and they're doing a really great job of it.
And so you're hearing from all these people from different places saying, mm-hmm. This works, suspensions don't work. And, this week nationally, it's called the National Week of Action on School Pushout, coordinated by the Dignity in Schools campaign. They're saying, they're against zero tolerance policies from California to Florida and Minnesota and Massachusetts. They're having protests and events and actions scheduled for today and scheduled for tomorrow. As a matter of fact, tomorrow there will be a youth rally in Fresno, California, and others, from Chicago to Miami. So this thing is catching on nationally. Why do you think, it's kind of like everybody agrees on this one? What is it about it?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's definitely, in the zeitgeist right now. It's, there's a big focus on the school-to-prison pipeline right now. Eric Holder and Arne Duncan have seen data coming out of Texas, a pretty large longitudinal study called Breaking School Rules that showed that the school-to-prison pipeline is very real, especially for African-American students, and that extends to referrals to special ed as well. Most of the students in Oakland who are pushed out of school or drop out of school enter the criminal justice system in some way or another, about two-thirds. And so people are seeing that suspensions aren't working, especially because so many of them are for defiance, which is a purely subjective definition. There is no common definition of that, so much so that in Los Angeles Unified, they actually banned a willful defiance as a reason for suspension.
But it's still a reason here.
It is, yeah. And that we're working on at least coming up with a definition for it right now.
You think you have support for that? That it will go forward as you like?
You mean coming up for a definition?
Yes.
Oh,
changing
definitely.
The definition. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's because of what you mentioned earlier with that voluntary resolution plan with the Office for Civil Rights. There's a lot of things coming out of that agreement, and one of them is that we will have a definition for defiance. Ultimately, maybe we won't.
And it won't include tapping a pencil on the desk. Hopefully.
No. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. We have more callers, but Damon, let me just go to you quickly. You hear about this, prison pipeline, school to prison pipeline. Do you see this around you? Do you see, colleagues, friends, kids from the neighborhood, kind of taking that step from high school and ending up in prison frequently?
Truth be told, every male member on my father's side of my family went from going to high school straight to jail right after high school. So I have a very good view of what's going on. I see it every day, even with people that aren't related to me, people who are related, people I know who have relatives. It's very common. It's very common.
Do you feel that had they had something like restorative justice in their schools, things would have been different for them?
Almost definitely. I feel as though if my father had restorative justice when he was my age, I think he would have I think he would have did the same thing I did at Bunch, graduated and moved on to something, you know, something better, as opposed to what he ended up going to jail for.
Okay. So let's go to more of your calls. Let's go to, let's see, Gina in Santa Cruz. Hi, Gina. Welcome to your call.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. Yeah, I just want to say that I think this is incredible. I've worked in schools in Oakland as a researcher and an educator. And the story that I think it was Eric that shared about the boy who was falling asleep on the desk and the teacher who reprimanded him and he cursed her out, that, I think, just gets at the crux of what I think is going on for so many young people in these communities. And it's a message that I really feel like the people who come from very privileged backgrounds, wherever that privilege comes from, really need to understand that core issue, that, you know, developmentally, kids who are dealing on a daily basis with stress and neglect in their lives cannot be expected to just pull themselves up by their bootstraps, which is a very kind of white privileged, you know, solution for issues around defiance with kids that are working from communities where they don't have very many assets in their lives. And so I think this message is so important, and the work you're doing is so important. And I came onto the call late, so I'm not sure if you already addressed this, but I'm just curious to know, one, what you're doing with parents to involve them in the process of RJ, and what your visions are, I guess, for, you know, potential future growth to get this message out beyond the people who understand these issues to those people that can provide support but don't understand why RJ's process is so important in turning around this kind of cycle of of prison, of school to prison.
Okay. Thank you, Gina. We'll take another call and then go back to answer Gina's questions. Let's go to Meg in Salinas. Welcome to your call, Meg.
Hello. Hi. Thanks for having me on. And, you know, thank you for having this discussion. It is so important. I can tell you, you know, I live in Salinas, and I served on the high school district for the local area, which basically is all the high schools except for the private schools. And I know that I attended a few classes for restorative justice in this area. And at the time that I had attended those, it was sort of still being piloted. But they were talking about candidates that they saw as good candidates for bringing this in. In other words, not everybody, just those that we see. And this is not through the school, this was through the county. Now, I will tell you, there are so many different things that I see just feed into problems with young men. First of all, this tends to be a problem that is young men. Young boys come in and into the high school system, or even prior to getting into the high school system, and their brains are not completely developed yet. They're adolescents. They're in a stage where they're growing. They do stupid things, you know, and for those of us old enough to remember, you know, or just even any of us going back and we think about some of the silly things that we did growing up, but we didn't have an internet, and we didn't have a fingerprint out all over the place following us around. Mm-hmm. And the money that is going into education, there's so much money going into education and so many different programs that get put in, taken out, and yet we still see the same problem, and it continues to grow. And some of the people that are really, I think, important in the conversation get pushed out, like educators, and don't really get listened to. And I see sometimes that we're not dealing with it the way that we should be dealing with it. And, you know, as an example, I will say that somebody who gets picked up and goes through probation, and they already have this mark on their head. Mm-hmm. Probation officers are in the schools. They see these kids. They're constantly coming up to these kids and, how are you doing today, and how things going, and those kids get marked. Mm-hmm. They can never get away from that mark on their head. You're on probation. They make one little mistake, and they stay in that system.
Okay.
Now, you know, I'll mention another thing about this. Felonies. If you commit a crime, and it's in excess of, I think it's $400, it becomes a felony. That's a very, very old standard.
Damon Smith just put up his hand five to say five.
$500.
$500.
Oh, $500 now. Okay, mm-hmm. So think about that in today's economy. At the time that $500 was implemented, and now in today's economy, there's a big difference. I mean, $20 a long time ago is not $20 now, right? So it's very, in other words, what I'm trying to say is, at the time that that was put into place, that was a pretty good amount of money. Today it's nothing.
Right.
In other words, these kids could end up with felonies and in big trouble over amounts of money that can be from, they tagged a fence and it's going to cost $500 to fix that fence. And yet they're really just trying to express what is going on inside.
All right. Thank you, Meg, so much for that call. Let's go back to Gina and answer her questions about parent involvement. Eric, how do you get the parents involved? At what point do you even call the parents?
As often as I possibly can. For me, I want to get an adult in the kid's face as much as possible. And I'd also like to have restorative conversation with adults. We've had circles with the police. We've had circles with the police. Just recently, we trained the district attorneys in Dallas to be able to have those conversations with kids. So just as often as I can have any adult in the company with kids having these conversations. And if a parent drops off a kid, I'm outside. I'm trying to build a relationship with that parent, so I can call and say, "Hey, let's have a conversation over some food and stuff like that." So any way that we can continue to have these conversations is.
David, there was a question mm-hmm. about outreach. How do you convince other areas and districts and people mm-hmm. about RJOY and restorative justice? RJOY is the organization.
RJOY is an organization. Right. Yeah, Eric works for RJOY.
Mm-hmm.
I don't convince people. I tell people what restorative justice is, and this spark gets lit or it doesn't. But if it doesn't and people participate in it, then they tend to believe in it. I think part of it is that, you know, people feel that, or people think that restorative justice is soft. You know, there's this whole thing, soft on crime, right? Like, oh, they write a hollow apology and then they're back in classroom.
And then there's some people who say, you know, we got an emailer who said, you know, these are bad kids. That's mm-hmm. why they're disciplined.
Mm-hmm. Well, so I want to correct that, because I think that's a misunderstanding of restorative justice. I think that there's nothing more consequential than being accountable for what you've done in a meaningful and relevant way to the people that you've harmed. Mm. And so I think being able to make it right when you've messed up is a gift, actually, to be able to give someone the chance to make it right again. Because I've spoken to many men in San Quentin who would love to be able to reach out to the people they've harmed to say, "I'm sorry, I'm trying my best to understand the impact that what I've done has had on your family." And here at school, because we've built these relationships with students, we can then have these difficult conversations with them, and they can sit down in a circle with the people that they've harmed and understand the impact that what they did had on them and themselves, and then come up with a plan to make it right. All this while keeping them as part of our community, not pushing them out.
Right.
And I think there are many students who would much rather be suspended or remain on probation or go to the juvenile justice center than sit in a circle with their grandmom and the people they've harmed and admit to what they had done and then seek to make it right.
Okay. We mm-hmm. only have a couple of minutes left. Let me read some emails from some of our listeners. Joshua Broadhead says he's a director of an after-school program in San Francisco, and they have been using restorative practices for a while now with great results. The after-school environment is often where more social issues bubble up after a long day in a more structured classroom. And another emailer said, activist educational motivators like Sister Soulja have pointed out how the energy itself of Black students is often abruptly disciplined by white teachers. As in my case, when I was an A student in a high school science class competing with another student for the highest grades. And we're about to wrap this up. You know, thank you all for being here. But I really want, Damon, I want you to have the kind of the final say today, and kind of tell me, where are you going from here? You've graduated. You're back on track. What is going to happen to Damon Smith?
I'm definitely getting back into school. I'm not so sure about my major. I'm kind of deciphering between psychology and chemistry because I feel like I talk to people good enough to be a psychologist, but I was always good. I was always the only kid in science class who wouldn't break or destroy anything in chemistry experiments. So, and I always thought about being a forensic chemist, like the people on CSI.
Ooh, yeah.
Who would like, okay, let me throw this something acid on top of it. Oh, that's blood because the acid turned green. I always wanted to do something like that. Like, if I learned that, I would be able to figure out if my little brother actually took my socks, used them, and put them back in my drawer like he did it, or did he wash them and put them back in my socks? Like, just want to know everything.
That's much. All. That's the only reason you want to be a forensic chemist for, yeah.
And
basically.
I want to go back to school because... During my earlier high school career, I wasn't as good as I was at Butch, so I never got the chance to completely play football.
All right. Well, good luck, Damon.
Can I just say...
We have 10 seconds left.
Damon graduated with a 3.8 grade point average, so restorative justice did not just have...
Right. You have the smarts already.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Most of our kids do.
David Usim, Eric Butler, Damon Smith, thank you so much for being here. Thank you to all our callers. Sorry if we couldn't get to you. Thank you to the emailers. And I'm Hannah Baba, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. This has been Your Call, and here's what's coming up tomorrow.
What are the successes and failures of the Affordable Care Act so far? On the next Your Call, we'll continue our series about health care. More than 2 million people have now signed up for Obamacare. And as new policies go into effect, we'll look at what's working and what's gone wrong. Are enough people taking part to make the program viable? And what's in store for costs and expanded coverage? Join the conversation and call in with your questions on the next Your Call with Holly Kernan and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Debbie Kennedy is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.